This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, and we are reviewing a week of sneak peeks, from political races to vaccine consequences. A new WBUR poll shows Michelle Wu out of Anissa Sibey-George by more than 30 points with likely voters. Wu is sanguine.
It's always affirming and exciting to see signs that our message and our approach is connecting with residents.
While Sibey-George shrugs, saying the numbers don't change her approach.
Yeah, no, they don't. We saw lots and lots of polls leading up to the preliminary, and we kept strong and focused on our strategy.
And as vaccine deadlines loom, fights heat up, sneak peeks at the arguments that we will see from those challenging the mandates here and those supporting them. So here is Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Greeney for the state and James Lamond representing correctional officers in court yesterday.
If a person does not want to get vaccinated, they do not have to, but there will be employment consequences.
That does adjust in a fairly fundamental way the rights and responsibilities that they had negotiated.
And then Governor Charlie Baker tips his hand about how the state could shift the landscape on green energy as the debate blows fiercely over offshore wind.
And now these wind farms, just it's almost like that's the final nail in the coffin. I hope I'm wrong.
Fisherman David Arapach, who fishes from Nantucket to New Jersey there. So let's dive right in. And we're going to start with the latest numbers on the mayoral race. Do you see big differences between the two final candidates? Anyone making their mark for you? And what do you want to hear about the issues? And which issues do you want to hear about in these last 2 weeks or so? Join this conversation. Call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Our panelists this week, WBUR senior news analyst John Carroll and Jane Swift, former governor of Massachusetts and president and executive director of Learn Launch. John, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Jane, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks for having me again.
So let's start with the reactions to the poll conducted by WBUR, Dorchester Reporter, the Boston Foundation, and the last partner was Mass Inc. Polling Group. This is a 32-point spread among likely voters with a margin of error of less than 5%. So what do you make of that, John Carroll?
Well, I think the race is shaping up the way everyone expected it to. Michelle Wu got the most votes in the preliminary by, I think, 11,000 votes. Anissa Sibey-George had basically a constituency that was significantly different from Michelle Wu's. And the sort of coalition that Michelle Wu has put together, it goes across demographics. I mean, she's leading in virtually every demographic, whites, African-Americans, Latinos, Asians. So she is in a strong position. And this race is basically an attempt by Anissa Sibey-George to set contrast between the two that will resonate with people. And so far, at least the poll shows that that hasn't happened.
Okay, there are like 15 things I want to pick up on that, John. I think the first one, and I'll turn to you with this, Jane. John talked about the favorability that Wu has across a lot of different demographics. One thing that did strike me, her favorability in the city of Boston is actually higher than Governor Baker's. He has had a pandemic to make that kind of hay. Where is that level of favorability coming from in a Boston city councilor? Now, granted, she's served since 2013, but still, where are those levels of favorability coming from, do you think, Jane Swift?
Well, I think actually she has not had to make the executive decisions in a pandemic. And they're just not easy decisions to make in a crisis. I think she also has benefited from the fact that it was pretty clear in the preliminary that the race was for second place. And so many of the candidates began to go after each other, and she emerged virtually unscathed. So there was ground to be made up afterwards. And she's been able, frankly, to be fairly nonspecific. She has promised a lot of, I think, very lofty and broad commitments without having to get to the details, which, by the way, if she's successful, I think she'll see that when you have to actually govern, it's not as simple. And that's when those numbers start to come back to earth.
Listeners, are you supporting one or the other of the candidates? We'd like to hear from you. 800-423-8255. So let's talk about that making up ground. And John, you talked about Asaibe George needing to make some distinctions. I'm going to play a little sound here. This is the two of them on rent control at the first one-on-one TV debate on WBZ Channel 4 earlier this week, which it was moderated by John Keller. Here we go.
Rent control is not the answer. It is not the fix to the challenge here in the city. And I'd like to understand how Michelle will put rent control in place here in the city of Boston and how she'll protect those small landlords that are such an important part of our city.
Response.
We can't be afraid and listen to scare tactics around what our residents need right now.
So, John, there we have one of the areas where the two candidates clearly do differ. And Wu has been the only candidate in this race all along who has supported rent control, which she calls rent stabilization. There's Asaibe George kind of swinging hard and Wu saying that's a scare tactic.
Well, it may not be a scare tactic, but it's a practical matter that the mayor of Boston cannot institute rent control unilaterally. This is something that has to go through the state legislature, number one. But on the other hand, Michelle Wu is onto something because there's a majority of Boston residents who approve of rent control and would like to see rent control. Asaibe George says, you know, it failed before. It hasn't worked, and it disadvantages the real estate, the landlords and real estate developers, one of which is her husband, which I don't think came out in the debate, at least not the half hour that was broadcast on television. So I think this is an issue that has appeal with the public. The less specific you are about it, the better it plays, I think. And that's one of the issues here in this race. I think if you watch the debate, major parts were painfully vague and jargon riddled. It was all about partnerships and shareholders and bringing stakeholders to the table. There was very little in particular specifics that either candidate talked about, and I think that was one of the problems. But for Michelle Wu, that freezes the race, and that helps her because all she wants to do is avoid any kind of major slip up, major mistake, and she did that during the debate.
So just to clarify for listeners, John, you were referring there to the fact that Anissa Asaibe George's husband owns developments and is a landlord. There was controversy earlier in the race over Asaibe George's team approaching the zoning board on something that it turned out affected her husband's properties. It did come up in the WBUR radio debate prior with Boston Globe prior to the preliminary election. It did not come up on the Channel 4 debate. So now, Jane, I want to pick up on John's arguments about there's just not a lot of specifics here either way. I'm going to play another juxtaposition for you. This is on schools. And of course, you being executive director of Learn Launch, which is digital learning, have a point of view on schools and education. So here they are again Wednesday night.
We've got a great deal of work to do. So much of that I have started as a member of the city council, work that we have achieved, that we've gotten done. The task list is long. Put a teacher in charge and a BPS mother in charge, and we will get that done.
Do you hear something you want to respond to there?
I'll just add that, you know, we can talk about big picture policies in the schools. We can talk about all the structural changes that we need. But at the end of the day, when your kids are in the school system, it is the little details that sometimes can have the biggest impact.
So flipping the script there too, Jane, because Wu has often been accused by Asaibe George and other candidates before the preliminary of being sort of more 30,000 feet. And here she is saying the details are what matters. But we have John saying, boy, there sure haven't been a lot of details.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And I think that you know, Asaibe George tried very hard to get to some details. And that was, I think, a very classic move by Michelle Wu, where perhaps she knew that her detailed positions, although not completely clear what those were, if they got into them, might be more popular. I think that the that is one area where we know that, you know, candidate Asadi George is a former teacher, and that should resonate. But to date, it has not. And so Wu was trying to turn the focus back to being a parent in the system, which also, I think, does carry some credibility. But that's more persona, not policy.
And it was something to note that they were both saying that they were Boston Public School parents, and that having a parent in the mayor's chair would make a difference in the schools. 1-800-423-8255. We have a call from Andrew in West Roxbury. Andrew, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? I'm going to try to be real concise. I'm not even particularly that fond of Michelle Wu one way or another, but in a race where social justice reform and affordable housing are important, I don't want to see my next mayor be basically a slumlord bankrolled by cops.
Thank you.
Asabi George's husband's interest. One thing that the Globe pointed out in their expose is that legally there is no distinction between his financial interest and her financial interest.
Thanks, Andrew. And we did check, just folks, with Andrew beforehand. He's not working for either of the campaigns. If you want to take counterpoint, if you are a supporter for Asabi George, who's also not working for the campaign, call 800-423-8255. So, John, there's Andrew picking up on the thread that you had raised around housing and Asabi George's husband. Also, endorsements. She's got police endorsements, many labor union endorsements. Of course, you know, we also know lots of endorsements for Michelle Wu. She's been bringing them out sort of in a regular drumbeat since the preliminary election. What about endorsements in this race, John?
Well, I think they carry some weight, usually, but the big issue is, will they result in turnout? And you wonder if the machine that that Marty Walsh built can be accessed by anybody. You know, it's the unions probably have a better infrastructure in terms of voter turnout, but also the influence of the establishment politicians. I mean, Michelle Wu has endorsements from Elizabeth Warren, Ed Markey, Ayanna Pressley, a number of different state lawmakers. So I think that that's important, but the question is, who's got the ability to turn voters out on election day? And I'm not sure that that's going to actually happen out of the state house. It might happen out of some of the union halls.
So that is interesting, Jane Swift. You know, we played that sound on purpose where you hear Asabi George say about the poll, yeah, it doesn't really matter for our strategy. And that is because she has argued that her strategy is truly retail, face-to-face, one-on-one, in communities that will then turn into getting out the vote. I think about that, and I think about a 32-point spread among likely voters. And, you know, as somebody who's got experience in campaigns and elections, how important is that 32-point spread in a poll? And how capable is one of using retail politics to get out the vote and close that kind of gap?
Well, the reason that get out the vote matters and the polling issue is it really only matters who shows up to vote. And so I'm sure the modeling for the BUR poll was fantastic, but I think a lot of people were very surprised at the lack of enthusiasm for this preliminary race. And so that can lend much more strength to the candidate who's more organized on the ground. And that's why I think it is right, as John said, you know, organization matters, people who are traditionally organized. I would say I don't think a modeling, you know, shading or error, or it wouldn't be an error, but like modeling the race turnout is not going to make up 32 points. I think if you start to see this gap close, which is, and it was the candidate who brought up that, you know, she saw the same thing play out in the preliminary, but we saw those polls starting to close. They may not have gotten the turnout exactly right. And one of the things back when I used to teach political leadership that the pollsters who came and spoke always talked about is polls are most accurate in predicting momentum and direction. So I think it'll be important to see if there's movement over the next couple of weeks. And if there's movement and it is closing the gap, then I'd put a lot more weight on the get out the vote and the grassroots efforts.
Let's pick up another call here. 800-423-8255. We have Betty on the line in West Roxbury. Betty, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I would like to see from both candidates specifics regarding quality of life issues in Boston, and I am specifically referring to infrastructure, trash on our streets, terrible road conditions, traffic, tree cover, trees being planted all over the place and never watered, dying. I just haven't heard anything from them about that. And, you know, I feel like I know a lot about many other issues, but, you know,
Betty,
taxpayer dollars are important, and I'd like to see some talk about infrastructure. Thank you.
Betty, thank you. And John, Betty's call gives me a chance to bring up something else. It's a little horse racy, but I do want to bring it up because you have this one-on-one candidate debate the other night. Halfway through, Channel 4 goes to Jeopardy, and the remaining portion of the debate goes online. You have to find it online. And interestingly, in that second half of the debate, the phrase quality of life actually came up. Planting trees came up, trash removal came up, potholes came up, all those things did, but it had gone online. And those, I think, who did tune in most dropped off when Jeopardy came on. So are we also giving air to the issues in the places that people need us to for voters to be informed, John?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, when you think of the typical broadcast television viewer, when you put up on the screen, scan this QR code to go to CBSN for the second half of the debate. I mean, there's no part of that that a lot of the TV viewers would understand. You know, half of them are at home with a VCR flashing 12 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 12 o'clock. So, you know, that was problematic. And I don't understand why BZ couldn't have gone over to its sister station, TV 38. But anyway, quality of life is important. But the BUR poll, two things I wanted to go back to. The BUR poll said, you know, the issues that polled highest were schools at 82%, housing at 74%, and public transit at 69%. So that's one thing in terms of the hierarchy of issues that that the public at least is responding to that poll with. The other is this 25% undecided in the poll. So Savvy George, if she has a hope, one of them would be to try to garner that undecided vote. And I think the debate did highlight the contrast between the two candidates. You know, and the idea of, you know, one who is sort of a technocrat and the other who is trying to present herself and is, you know, a authentic member of the community that she's looking to be mayor of. So I think at least if nothing else, people took away that contrast between the two candidates.
Okay, for now, we're going to end that part of the conversation there. But listeners, join us next week at 7 p.m. on October 18th and the 21st for two one-on-one WBUR town halls with the Boston mayoral candidates, Michelle Wu, Anissa Saibi George. I will be moderating. I'd love to see you there. We will be asking your questions both nights. That's next Monday and Thursday. So for free tickets and to submit those questions in advance, which you need to do, go to wbur.org/events. I'm Tiziana Deering, and still with us, WBUR senior news analyst John Carroll and former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift. And you, join the conversation. Let's talk about deadlines for vaccine mandates, private and public. Give us your reaction to acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey suspending hundreds of employees this week for failing to meet the city's requirements, or the Corrections Officers Union taking Charlie Baker to court this week. And what are you thinking about potential losses of workforce, if there are some, when there's already a labor shortage, versus responsibility of people who are in public health and public safety to get vaccinated to keep other people safe? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Okay, Jane, so much to talk about here. Let me ask you, we're hearing a lot about consequences. Are you worried about people losing their jobs, or is it their fault for not following the guidelines?
So I'm always worried about people losing their jobs, but I'm also worried about us never getting back to normal. You know, I have longed for the day when that statistic that John quoted, that people would care the most about education in any race, and in a mayoral race, would happen. But I think that those two issues, right, this issue about vaccine mandates and education popping to the top of voters' minds, are not disconnected. Women are leaving the workforce in enormous numbers because of the unbelievable disruption that has happened to our education system and our daycare and early child care system because of the continued implications of COVID. So I'm worried about people losing their jobs, but it's clear that high vaccination rates is the only way to get us back to normal. And so I think that this is responsible public policy, and there are a limited number of ways that those with health issues can get a waiver. And so hopefully this will get us back to normal.
So, John, there's Jane sort of giving you the tensions in a nutshell. And Jane, the last thing you said was this question of, you know, there are waivers, there are exemptions. John, we had some sound on WBUR from SEIU Local 509 Union. Peter McKinnon is the president there. It's a human service workers union. And talking about the different agencies in the state who are using different criteria for religious and medical exemptions, creating a moving target.
One agency maybe is applying this set of criteria for exemption requests, whereas another agency is applying a different set of criteria. And it shouldn't be that way.
And that's part of a larger set of pushback, John, and we heard some of it at the very top of the show, too, just around the way the state is doing this. Hey, this steps outside of our negotiated contracts. Hey, you know, you're not being consistent in your execution of it. To what extent should that figure into what happens to people who are refusing to get vaccinated, John?
I think what you want is the most effective system that you can achieve. And I think that one of the things the correctional officers brought up in court was that the state mandate has, the deadline is this Sunday, the state mandate has no allowance for testing as an option, as opposed to a number of other mandates, including the federal mandate. So I think that that's a legitimate issue, that there should be some kind of option, and there should be some kind of standardized waiver process that people can rely on, so that you know that if you're in this town or in this job, you'll have the same chance of getting a waiver as someone else. And for that to be arbitrary, I think is really unfortunate. But it all plays into the basic problem here, which is this isn't as much a public health issue as a culture war. And the culture war is basically stagnating at this point. You know, we have pretty much reached the threshold that we're going to get to in terms of who's willing to be vaccinated and who isn't. And I think that that's a basic problem that has to be addressed at some point. I think that there's no way that that people are going to reach any kind of unanimity about this until there's somehow we address the culture war aspect of it.
So, Jane, I'm going to bring another voice in here. But first, listeners, join this conversation. Are we at an impasse in terms of people getting vaccinated, people pushing back on mandates? Are we just where we're going to be? Or is there more headway that we can make as community? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So yesterday, Jean Swift, we spoke with MGA President Dr. David Brown. Now, they, as John pointed out with the state, they have a vaccine mandate that allows for exemptions, but you cannot do a testing option. So first, he does not want to fire anyone, even though their deadline was today. And as of yesterday, they had about 800 employees who were not yet in compliance.
It is our goal to fire no one. It is our goal to protect all of our employees with vaccination as we protect all of our patients by vaccinating our staff.
And then to that impasse point, I asked him, Jane, well, as somebody who ran the emergency department during the beginning of this pandemic and saw the devastation, are you frustrated with your employees in a hospital that won't get vaccinated? Here he is.
It doesn't frustrate me, but it concerns me. We're a healthcare organization, and our responsibility is to provide a safe and welcoming environment to our patients.
So thinking about what John said, Jane, and thinking about the countless public leaders we've talked to on the show here over the months who are trying to figure out what message they give people to get them to do this, how does one think about that in a public leadership role at this point?
So I think it's very interesting that we saw vaccination rates go up as we saw this spike in basically there was clear evidence that those without vaccines got very sick and some of them died. And people with vaccines, while there were some breakthrough cases, in only very rare cases did those folks die. And all of a sudden, a number of people who had previously not stepped forward. And so I think there's a few things. There's a great article in the New York Times that talked about there's a lot, frankly, that we still don't know about the science of COVID, and being really clear about those things we do know and not overstating on the things we don't, I think is important. I think that that's where we have confused the message before. I wish, and you know, Tiziana, I have a very personal stake in this. Yeah. My husband is highly immune compromised. We've been dealing with my oldest daughter who's got, you know, a roommate, frankly, who is not COVID conscious. And it's brutal. It's brutal for my daughter who's trying to, you know, balance a, you know, sick father and finish her classes. I wish that people would respond to the message of, you know, do it for everyone, do it for the least of our brothers, all those sort of community. They won't. People are responding to what impacts them and clear and convincing evidence that they themselves or their direct family members will be safer if they get the vaccine. And I think that has to be the message.
All right. We've got some calls here. I'm going to take a couple back to back. So we've got Megan on the line in Watertown. Megan, go ahead.
Hi. Two things. One, if people don't want to get the shot, they're not being forced to. They just have to get the shot if that's what they want to do for work. And also, if they don't want to protect the community, then they shouldn't be in the community. Stay home. But if you're not willing to protect others, then you don't really have the right to be out and about and possibly infecting others.
Thanks for that call, Megan. Nancy is in Ashland. Nancy, go ahead.
Yes, I want to say three little words to sum it all up. Vaccine, save lives. There was an international campaign to eliminate smallpox by inoculation worldwide. It worked. There's no more smallpox virtually on the planet. We must be vaccinated.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you for that.
I got the shot in February and March, and I'm looking forward to the booster.
All right, and I love it that Nancy brought in the boosters there, John Carroll, because that is the other fascinating thing. You got some huge portion of the country racing towards boosters, right? Waiting for those announcements like the FDA made today that they're going to support, the advisory panel supports boosters for all J&J recipients after 2 months. And then a percentage of the country racing as hard as they can away from all vaccinations, kind of to your point from earlier.
Yeah, I mean, the booster is a two-edged sword because the people who are opposed to vaccination basically are saying, well, look, the booster proves it doesn't work. So, you know, I'm going to go get some horse dewormer or something to use instead. So the reasoned approach is not working in this situation because this is really emotional. This is really cultural. There's a new poll that just came out that said fewer than half of Republicans say parents should be required to vaccinate their kids against any infectious disease. 46% say that they should be vaccinated. A year ago, it was 64% of Republicans thought they should be vaccinated. So this is having spillover effects that are really unanticipated. But the idea that let's not just protest the COVID vaccine, let's protest all vaccines, is something that's taking root in this segment of the population that is adamant that they do not want to participate in this public health campaign or effort.
All right. So I want to get us in one more subject before we go to our hubbub. So I am going to shift gears now. And callers, we will do Ask the Doctors again next Tuesday. These last couple of days, there have been a lot of new information about Moderna boosters, J&J boosters. We will have an Ask the Doctors next week. You will be able to call in with your coronavirus questions, as we often do. Okay, before we go to hubbubs, there is another headline I want to talk about, and I'm actually going to quote directly from the State House News Service here. Quote, Governor Charlie Baker announced sweeping legislation Wednesday to reshape the way Massachusetts procures offshore wind power. End quote. Now, that's one part using $750 million. That would not be enough. $750 million in federal stimulus funds on this. But also changing who picks the winning bids, because believe it or not, right now, executives from National Grid, Eversource, and Unitil pick winners of these kinds of bids with state help. So, Jane, I mean, this is a new industry coming. Some predictions are a $1 trillion industry coming. Have we moved fast enough? And what do you make of this proposal?
So most new industries need some government involvement. I think that it is important that Massachusetts, which is such a leader in innovation, be a leader in green energy as well. I think it's just important that we make sure we call on all of the experts that we have at our disposal in this very wicked smart state that we have to ensure that we're making the right choices. I do think it should be innovation and experts, non-biased, of course.
So, you know, we've done some coverage of this week, John Carroll, and the potential specifically of offshore wind to create equity. You know, we often talk about new industries being a chance to create some equity. Here is former New Bedford City Councilor Dana Ribeiro, who's working for Vineyard Wind on building equity in offshore wind.
There hasn't been a new industry in New Bedford for quite some time. Our poverty levels are pretty staggering, you know? So for me, it's about helping people keep their dignity. And part of dignity is being able to have a dream, pursue your dream.
So the dignity at the heart of it here. And yet, as we saw with cannabis, John, we had great intentions to create equity and then built a structure that wound up creating a lot of barriers to equity. Can we do that here? And are we thinking far enough ahead to be successful, John?
We can try, but I mean, there's two parts to this. One is you want to build equity, and that's a laudable goal. But also the collateral damage from something like wind farms and massive wind farms. Vineyard Wind is going to install 62 turbines 15 miles from Martha's Vineyard. You know, that's going to affect fishing in, you have to believe, a significant way. And so New Bedford, where there are a lot of fishermen, you know, are they going to be the ones who reap the benefits of equity, the people who have been disadvantaged by it? I'm not opposed to wind power. In fact, you know, fossil fuels are having a really bad year right now in terms of energy inflation. It's running way ahead of any other inflation. But I think that the spillover effects of what's going to happen is something that has to be taken seriously and somehow, you know, level off the books. You know, balance the ledger so that the people who are adversely affected are maybe first in line for any kind of equity efforts.
So just briefly, Jane Swift, I'm mindful of WBUR reporter Miriam Wasser's work this week, along with E&E News, where they talked about the fact that most of the jobs in this industry are going to be in building the stuff it takes to build the wind turbines, and that we're way behind in the country here, that most of that capacity is in Europe right now. As a former governor, can our state do what it needs to do to get in that game? Can we do that on our own?
I don't know if we can do it on our own as a state. We might be able to do it as a region, but we certainly should pressure the federal government, particularly given all the supply chain issues we're running into, to make sure we do more of that manufacturing in the U.S. and that it's equitable.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to continue to follow this. This is, again, the potential here for a $1 trillion global industry. Massachusetts is playing. The governor's putting out new legislation. There are plans to build turbines. It is something we'll continue to follow. But right now, we want to leave time for some hubbubs, which are those little or maybe not so little this time stories that caught our attention this week. Jane, I happen to know your hubbub, and I'm planning to give you an assist on it. So we're going to do yours second. John, I think you've got a fun one for us, too. So let me turn to you first. What do you have?
So MassMutual, the insurance company, just launched an ad campaign that features two NHL players, Alex Ovechkin and Nicholas Backstrom, along with Ovechkin's wife, Nastya. Here's how the TV spot starts out.
Hey, Alex, why is Backstrom on your life insurance policy?
We're a duo.
A duo?
Yeah. If something happened to me, who is Becky going past to pass to? His power play points might drop. How he will get his assist? What then?
Yeah, what then?
So this is just wrong in so many ways because MassMutual is headquartered in Springfield, Massachusetts. So why are they using two players from the Washington Capitals in $1.5 million ad campaign? Why not Patrice Bergeron and David Pasternak? Why not Brad Marchand? One of those choices where, you know, you look at it and you say, didn't anybody in the conference room say, hey, guys, you know, shouldn't we hire locally? So I think that every right-thinking person in Massachusetts should send a letter to MassMutual headquarters. It's 1295 State Street in Springfield. And thank you for your support.
John Carroll, I love it. Outstanding. Outstanding. Okay, Jane Swift, you are sticking with us on sports here, and I know you have a Red Sox hubbub for us, so I'm going to give that its due by bringing in an assist here. Chris Siderick, who helps us check the score, is here with us now. Chris, come on in.
Hey, everybody.
All right, so Jane, we've already, and Chris, by the way, you couldn't see him, John, but Chris, you were digging what John was
saying. Oh, I love that. John, you are preaching. Everybody send those letters, absolutely. The address was the kicker.
All right.
Jane, I want to know, before you get to your hubbub, I want you to know, I brought props into the studio with me.
Oh, good.
We are ready. And baseball, it should be noted, is an incredibly superstitious sport, right? We were talking
so
earlier.
Superstitious.
I'm wearing my Big Poppy jersey, which I bought in 04 at the beginning of the Yankee series, so you know it's got some serious mojo. I am a believer. In what you're about to give us. So, Jane, go ahead and spit some truth for us.
All right. So, some people may have seen my fun little column today for WBUR's Cognoscenti, but my family are huge Red Sox fans. And I'm now very cool because I have older children. And my daughter has turned me on to the Section 10 podcast. And Steve Peralt has been having all of us eat rally cups, which are, of course, it just turns out, my very favorite.
The best candy.
You can say it. Reese's peanut butter cups. And this is what people need to know. You have got to eat Reese's peanut butter cups during every Red Sox game. When Steve has us eating rally cups, the Red Sox are winning 87.5% of the time. Without rally cups, we're at like 56%, a little under that.
Take that, stat nerds. I love it.
Oh, my God.
Well, dentists are going to love this, too.
And Peloton, Hydro, every gym in Massachusetts and New England. But, you know, sometimes you just have to take one for the team.
All right, so Chris brought us rally cups here. We have Reese's, and I promise you that on the break, I am going to take an entire rally cup.
No. You've got to wait till the game
Oh, no, there's
starts.
More. Oh, trust me. There are more at home, too. All right, Jane, you have set up our check the score after the break beautifully there, and the two of you, those were awesome hubbubs. So, Chris, you're going to stick around till after the break.
You know
in the meantime, Jane Swift, former Massachusetts governor and president and executive director of Learn Launch. Jane, thank you for Week in Review today.
Thank you.
And John Carroll, WBUR senior media analyst and postal address provider extraordinaire. Thanks for joining us today, John. It was great to have you.
Happy to be of service.